the Global Research NewsHour. This is Michel Chalcedovsky. Our program comes to you from Montreal. It is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Today we are joined by Andrew Marshall, who is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. He's joining us from Montreal. And we will be discussing issues pertaining to world government, as well as the broader issue of currency and global currency, focusing also on the ongoing debate, and of course, the global economic crisis, which is affecting us. I should mention that Cynthia McKinney was scheduled to join this program this morning as well, and unfortunately, due to an emergency and commitments, she's unable to make it. Let's proceed. Andrew, good morning. I think Andrew is not. Hello.
Hello.
Yo, hi. Good morning,
hi.
Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're delighted to have you comment on issues of global government, which of course is something which is on everybody's mind at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote an article a few months ago on the issue of global currency and world government.
Yeah.
Focusing on the G20 summit and so on. What kind of currency arrangements are currently being envisaged by the G20, and would these arrangements eventually replace the US dollar?
Well, firstly, they're starting to create or issue the SDRs, the special drawing rights, through the International Monetary Fund. This was a decision made by the G20 in April. And what this means is that that's going to be a basket of currencies. The special drawing rights are a synthetic paper currency, an international currency, and its value is determined by a basket of different global currencies like the dollar, the yen, the euro. And so ultimately what this does is it's putting a global currency into play. And they're starting to issue loans already to African countries through the IMF of special drawing rights. And so what they're doing is they're starting the process of creating a world reserve currency. And ultimately this will replace the dollar as the world reserve currency. The dollar will still exist, I think, for some time, until its very possible collapse and possible replacement by a North American currency, which would then be within the basket of currencies at the IMF.
Well, I mean, in a sense, we might ask ourselves, is this a new financial arrangement? Because at the moment, the special drawing rights are used really as an accounting principle, but they also used loans are, in fact, have for many, many years been granted in the form of SDRs. The U.S. dollar has a 44% weight in the composition of the SDR, and I think the euro is something like 30-35.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in effect, does this really change the rules of the game? Because, in effect, these two currencies would still dominate the process of money creation.
Yeah, well, they're still talking about reforming the percentages and changing the arrangements of who has what interest within the SDRs, but that's still yet to be determined.
Well, we have to go to a short commercial break. We'll be back with our guest, Andrew Marshall, associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. Stay with us.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. My name is Michel Chosadovsky. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. With us, our guest, Andrew Marshall, who is an independent writer based in Vancouver and research associate of our research center. Welcome back, Andrew. I just to follow up on the issue of global currency, which we were discussing. You, in your research, you focused very much on the role of major financial conglomerates such as the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. Mm-hmm. And in essence, who is behind the global currency initiative? Is it an initiative of governments, or is it an initiative of financial institutions?
It's an initiative essentially of a cartel of private interests. And it's essentially these large banking families, and these families almost function as conglomerates. And they are the major shareholders in the central banking system of the world, which is itself a private system. Privately owned shareholders own the central banks of the world, and they operate in a centralized fashion through the Bank for International Settlements, which is also a private organization owned by the central banks. And these interests are the ones promoting this idea of a world currency, and that have backed this idea for so many years and have pushed not only this idea, but the whole concept of world governance and world government. And it's these families which control the major financial institutions, and not just families, but individuals and associates and just their whole social groupings. They own the financial institutions. They control the governments. They at least influence politicians and are the major players in the global economy. And so they're able to, through the Bank for International Settlements and through their central banks, they're able to manipulate currency flows and manipulate economies. And so their actions tend to benefit them. It doesn't necessarily benefit the economy or industry of a nation, or even the political structure, the stability of a country. It just generally benefits them.
Now, at the moment, the Chinese are perhaps the largest creditors of the United States, because mm-hmm. they hold large amounts of U.S. denominated debt.
Mm-hmm.
If the U.S. dollar were to crash, I presume the main victims would be the Chinese, who hold the Chinese, the Japanese, and other, of course,
yeah,
in general. So that does the crash of the dollar ultimately? What does the crash of the dollar really mean if such a thing were to occur?
The crash of the dollar would not only collapse the United States and greatly affect China and other holders of debt, but it would collapse the whole international monetary system, which is built upon the U.S. dollar and has been since the post-war period, specifically 1971, when Nixon dropped the link to gold. And this whole international monetary system would collapse. It would be a clear signal of a global depression. But it would also be a massive catalyst for change in the direction that these banks, that these bankers and financial institutions want to move, and that would be to create this international currency and to use it as a catalyst to create world governance. And, like China is promoting this idea of a global reserve currency. Even the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, recently brought out a coin saying this is the new international currency. And I saw that India just got on board with this idea of a new international reserve currency. And these are, representative of the BRIC countries, and the big rising powers. And they're all promoting this idea of a new global reserve currency. And, you know, it's not that China came up with this idea independently on its own. You know, China financially is within the Western sphere of control. And so this is something that's been fostered, and economically they're promoting ultimately these powerful Western interests, but at the demise of the U.S. dollar at the same time.
But is this something a little bit cosmetic in these statements by China, Russia, and India? I mean, India is heavily indebted to the IMF and the World Bank. Russia's financial system is extremely fragile. And if I presume that if a special drawing rights currency were to emerge, these countries may, in fact, be lobbying to have their currency included, so it would remain a composite, and I presume it would still remain a composite with the dollar and the euro dominating, so that in effect, I don't think that these countries are in fact challenging the preeminence of the dollar. One has the feeling that there's a lot of political rhetorics behind these statements.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, no matter what, the interests that control the dollar, whether or not the dollar survives, is somewhat irrelevant, because the interests that control the dollar itself will ultimately control whatever new currency or special drawing rights emerges. So it's the same interest internationally. And so the dollar in that sense is irrelevant in whether or not it itself plays the part as global currency, or has the major interest within the special drawing rights. Ultimately, it'll be the same interest controlling this international currency.
Now, when the euro emerged as a global currency in 1999, 2000, this was viewed, I think, correctly as a challenge to the predominance of the U.S. dollar. In other words, the euro is backed essentially by a handful of Western European financial institutions, the Deutsche Bank, and perhaps a handful of French and Italian. Do you view a conflict between Anglo-American banking interests on the one hand and the predominantly European Franco-German? There's always been a discussion and debate concerning the so-called Franco-German alliance, opposed to the Anglo-American perspective. What is your take on that?
I think it's a possibility of conflict between the two camps, I guess you could say. But ultimately, I think that going high enough on the ladder, they're essentially the same interests, because these powerful interests do not identify through nationality. These bankers have no nation. They see themselves as internationalists, so they will manipulate countries against one another and have their interest in all very different countries, very different opposing currencies. And I think ultimately the idea of this euro and the dollar is to play them off against one another. And in 2008, the National Intelligence Council in the United States released a report called Global Trends 2025. The National Intelligence Council is made up of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, and they worked closely with major international think tanks like the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London, the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and they came up with this report analyzing trends for the future up to the year 2025. And in the report, they state that by the year 2025, there likely won't be a world government yet, and the process of a world currency will still be sort of on shaky ground, but that there will likely be three major regions in the world: Asia, North America, and Europe, and that these three will have regional currencies, which will play off against one another and be composed of a basket of currencies that will be a new international reserve currency. And it states that although by 2025, Asia may not have a unified monetary order by that time, but it would be in the works. And so ultimately, even you know, the intelligence community is aware of these trends towards regionalism and towards regional currencies, and that they would be playing off these major regional currencies against each other through this basket, which would make up this international reserve currency, which is, interestingly enough, what was undertaken a couple months after this report was released.
Now, to get back to these financial conglomerates and powerful families, you've done a fair amount of research on the Rothschilds and also on the Rockefellers, which
yep.
are perhaps the two of the most powerful financial families in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How does that relate to the issue of global currency?
Well,
are the Rothschilds involved in this project?
Yeah, and the Rockefellers themselves. And it really relates to the, both to their family histories, because they've been so involved. James Wolfensohn, who is the former president of the World Bank, gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations a couple years ago on the event of David Rockefeller's birthday. And he said in his speech, which is the transcripts available on their website, that no family has had greater influence in the advent of globalization than the Rockefellers. And, you know, they openly discuss, like in these transcripts, what kind of influence these people wield. And, you know, recently there was, or I think this was a year ago, where a banker with the Rothschild company in Europe said that to solve climate change, we need a world government. So they're still very much involved in these processes and largely through the central banking system.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which airs Monday through Friday at 10 Central Time out of Texas, courtesy of our station, RBN. Stephen Lendman hosts the program 3 or 4 days a week. This particular program comes to you from Montreal. It's Michel Chalcedovsky. Our guest is Andrew Marshall, research associate of our research center. Please consult our website at www.globalresearch.ca. Andrew Marshall's writings are published by globalresearch.ca. We are today focusing on the issue of global government and global currencies. Andrew, one important aspect of your analysis has been to focus on how these major financial and corporate interests make decisions, usually behind closed doors, not under any formal umbrella. You wrote a couple of months ago a very incisive article entitled The Bilderberg Plan for 2009. Could you perhaps elaborate on how this relates to the issue of global government and so on? This was the Bilderberg meeting back in May, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Bilderberg, founded in 1954, was founded initially to create the European Union. And recently its chairman said in European media that the euro was an advent of the Bilderberg Group. That's where it was discussed and decided upon. And ultimately it was to merge the Atlanticist elements. It was North American and Western European elites. And they aren't, a lot of people will criticize them, describing them as a secret world government. But that's sort of inaccurate and kind of overblows their influence. They're rather just the most powerful and preeminent global think tank. And this is where they meet in secret once a year. It's about 130 of the world's elite. And they discuss major issues and come up with plans of action. And they're very much the big globalist crowd. They've once been referred to as the high priest of globalization. And this last meeting in May, the leaked reports coming out, which were reported by Daniel Estulin and Jim Tucker, was that they were planning on creating a global treasury and a global Department of Health. Now, the global Department of Health would be through the World Health Organization, no surprise there, and the global treasury would probably be the IMF. And now this leaves the question of what would be the global central bank. And there's the question of whether or not the treasury and central bank would be the same institution, such as the IMF, which is where the G20 started issuing the new reserve currency through. But I think it's more likely that the Bank for International Settlement will become the global central bank. And it's these same interests, like David Rockefeller's at every Bilderberg meeting. You have these major financial interests. The Rothschild interests are there. The big central bankers of the world. So all these interests go to Bilderberg. And it's basically a global think tank where they meet once a year and determine a general policy for the next year, a general concept of what is to come. And they have discussion. There's various dissent within the group. It's not on whether or not to have a global currency or to have a global government, but dissent tends to be on how to get there. It's never on the ends. It's just on the means that they dissent with one another.
Now, essentially, if one establishes a global central bank and a global treasury, we're dealing with money creation. And in fact, those who control money creation, in fact, control the world because they
Absolutely.
Can, they have control over the real economy. They can issue currency.
Amschel Rothschild said, give me control of a nation's currency and I care not who makes its laws.
Well, exactly. Now, how does that, in effect, if you look at the current sort of neo-Marxist viewpoint, it is the ownership of capital which gives you power in the world capitalist system. And what you're suggesting, in effect, is somewhat different, is that if you control money creation, you don't even need to own capital. De facto, you can take control over real assets through through monetary emissions.
Yeah, it's not necessarily about who owns the means of production, because currency creation and central banking, these are not production. And so I guess through neo-Marxist terms, it would be more accurately described as accumulation by dispossession, in which they produce these currencies and money out of nothing, plunging both industry and government into debt, dispossessing them of their freedom, essentially. Dispossessing, you know, when you're debt is just another form of slavery. And so it brings them within their system. And through currency, through debt, you control. And it really goes back to the history of the central banking system. And that's how we've come to where we are today and defines where we're going.
We have to go to commercial break. We'll be back with Andrew Marshall after the break. This is Global Research News Hour.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal, broadcast out of Houston, Texas, through RBN. Our guest on the show this morning is Andrew Marshall, analyst and researcher based in Vancouver. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you.
I wanted to pursue the issue of the Rothschilds.
Yes.
Because they seem to be, in effect, invisible in this whole process. We know a lot about the Rockefellers.
Yeah.
Could you...
To explain, I think, the role of the Rothschilds, or more broadly, just these families in general, I think it's necessary to just quickly look at the central banking system, because this is ultimately where their power is wielded. And the Rothschilds date back centuries. It was really after the French Revolution that they rose up as a prominent banking family in Europe. And through the Napoleonic Wars, they became the preeminent banking and really the most wealthy family in the world. And it was through, they didn't start the process of creating the central banking system, or they didn't start this whole move towards control, but they certainly became one of the most prominent families and certainly figures within this whole system. And central banking really emerged in Britain in 1694 with the creation of the Bank of England, which is a private bank that creates and issues the British currency. And how central banks work is that they are all private institutions with shareholders, but they act in ways with public power and authority. So they create and issue a currency of a nation, determine interest rates, yet they are privately owned. And so how they work is that they loan the money to the government at interest. So their control and power comes through interest payments. They never want a country or industry to pay back a debt, because then they don't own them. So their control comes through the interest. And that is where the shareholders make a profit, through interest. And so the more money that's printed, the more wealth they get, the more power and the more control they have. And through the French Revolution, which led to powerful banking interests coming to great power in France, they decided to support a general named Napoleon, who came to power, and in 1800 he created the Bank of France, and he gave them their Bank of France. And they, you know, became the private shareholders, and this is where the Rothschilds entered the picture, really, in France, and they became significant shareholders in the Bank of France. And Napoleon had this one quote where he said, because he also bought shares in the bank, and he said, "The emperor is more the owner of the Bank of France than its shareholders." And then soon after that, he was gone.
Yes, that one, I remember
yes.
that.
But
so
they
the
remained.
Napoleon was, in effect, a puppet of the Rothschilds up to the point
and,
where he
decided. And more broadly, the large banking interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Rothschilds, I guess, specifically, but there was tons of interest. And in the Bank of France, they had Protestant and Jewish banking interest there, and they were kind of playing off against one another and were often in competition for who was controlling the major sources of power within the bank. But these various differences among them are kind of illusory and irrelevant, because ultimately their interests are the same.
No.
And it was through the Napoleonic Wars that the Rothschilds really became the preeminent force in Europe, because with the Battle of Waterloo, the Rothschild patriarch in London was infamous for getting news before anybody else, including the king, including the parliament, including anybody. And so when the Battle of Waterloo was going on, everybody kept their eye on Rothschild to see what he did on the stock market. If he sold shares, that meant that the British lost. If he bought shares, that meant that they won. So everybody was closely watching him that day. And he had a network of carrier pigeons, which made him get this information before anybody else. So he got news that the British won 24 hours before even the government got the news. Except what he did was that he quietly went onto the stock market and sold all his shares, indicating that the British lost. And so everybody went into a selling panic. The stock market collapsed. Everybody sold everything, and what he did was he bought everything up for pennies on the dollar, and essentially bought the entire British economy and the empire, essentially. And, you know, that was at the beginning of what became known as the British Imperial Century. So these Rothschilds were the British imperial family, more so than even the monarch. You know, Queen Victoria had a quote when the Rothschilds bought the Suez Canal for the British, where she said, "You can never have too many Rothschilds."
But at the same time, because the Rothschilds were both were on both sides of the British Channel, they had a foothold into French politics and French capitalism, I presume, as well.
Absolutely, and they had five major family banks. There was the French, the British, the Italian, the Austrian, and the German, I believe.
And I presume that this arrangement still prevails today.
They've expanded into North America, I guess you could say. And they're very closely allied with Rockefeller interests, and they were very closely allied with the Morgan family when they were the preeminent family in America. And, you know, they bought their shares in the Bank of England eventually, and so they bought into the central banking system, which brought them to this preeminent position. And, you know, eventually the central banking system throughout, you know, the whole history of the United States through the 19th century was the history of, you know, the public government against the central bank. It was basically a history of the people versus the bank. And, you know, this was from the very first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, created a central bank because he felt the government should be allied with powerful financial interests. And Thomas Jefferson, you know, rallied against it, but it was Hamilton who won out. Eventually that contract wore up and the bank was gone. But then this reemerged with Andrew Jackson, who vetoed the bill to create a central bank and was not in good favor with the bankers, but eventually they got their might and financial power behind instigating a civil war in the United States. And Lincoln has this quote during the Civil War where he said, "I have two enemies in this war. One is in front of me and one behind. In front of me I have the South, and behind me I have the bankers. Of the two, the one behind me is the greater foe." And he talked about how he envisioned an era in which corporations were enthroned and that they would come and destroy the republic while nobody could see them. And nobody would notice as they destroyed the republic. And ultimately, you know, in the 20th century, when they created the Federal Reserve in 1913, this was their coup, their financial coup over America. This was, as Cecil Rhodes always dreamed of, retaking America for the British Empire, for the Anglo-American Empire, retaking America. This was, they couldn't do it through military might or a frontal assault. They had to do it covertly, incrementally, financially, quietly, in the shadows. And this was how they did it. And there's a quote by Congressman Charles A. Lindbergh in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created, who said, "From now on, depressions will be scientifically created." And sure enough, every great financial calamity in the past century has been a result and can be directly related to Federal Reserve policies, from the Great Depression to the 1980s debt crisis and the current crisis, which is itself a major result of Federal Reserve policies. And so it's through these institutions that they exert their control. And the Rockefellers and the Morgans, they all helped create the Federal Reserve system, which was really ultimately an initiative of the Warburg family in Germany. And they're closely allied with the Rothschild interests over in Europe. And so all these families essentially work together. I think it's best to view them almost as a cartel, or in terms of a mafia. You know, you have all these various families playing the same game, working together. Every once in a while, there's a conflict between one, you know, a couple of the families. There may be a little infighting. One of the families gets taken out, you know, but ultimately they're all there to protect their game. And they're all going to work together to protect their game and their combined interests. And who sits at the head of this table? I don't know. I don't think there's really a way to know that. Could it be the Rothschilds? Absolutely. Could it be the Rockefellers? Absolutely. The Rockefellers are certainly more visible in terms of exerting influence, specifically since the post-war period. But, you know, the Rothschilds, they still have huge financial interests, and their firm is massively growing through this crisis. They're, you know, they're in charge. They're getting all these new contracts for restructuring economies, and it was the Rothschild firm that got the job of restructuring General Motors, you know. So they're doing quite well, and you know, through their interest in central banks, and they're going to be doing very well because central banks just keep printing more money. And you know, it's interesting if you look at the Federal Reserve System, the most powerful of the regional banks, which are the private banks, is the New York Fed. And of course, the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, was the former president of the New York Fed. But if you look at the board of the Fed, on it is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, which implies that J.P. Morgan Chase is a significant shareholder in the Federal Reserve System, which then comes as no surprise that the Federal Reserve of New York bought Bear Stearns for J.P. Morgan Chase. So in essence, this money that the Federal Reserve created to buy this other bank and consolidate it for J.P. Morgan Chase is paid for by the U.S. taxpayer on interest, but that interest ultimately goes to J.P. Morgan Chase interest also. So it's an amazing scam and an amazing sleight of hand.
I guess what comes to mind in this discussion is the whole issue of democratization of the central banking system and how to actually, for people or for societies or countries to recapture the control over money creation, which is essentially the whole basis democratic economic and social development.
Absolutely. I sometimes wonder how capitalism would have turned out had it not been for the central banking system. And I absolutely agree. I don't think we necessarily need a democratic central banking system, but rather, you know, call into question if we need central banks at all. Money can be created through a treasury department or ministry. You know, that used to be the role of such institutions and such departments, and therefore it is totally under control of the government, of the public sphere, of ultimately the people. And that is the way it has to be, because taking, you know, control, it's like, you know, Mayor Rothschild said, you know, give me control of the nation's currency, actually not who makes its laws. Well, the people should have control of the currency, you know, because then we, the people, determine the course of the nation, determine the course of economics, whether privately or publicly. But, you know, ultimately, monetary power has to be publicly controlled. Because if it's private, then all that will result is debt, crisis, war, consolidation, and international centralization of power. And that is exactly what we're seeing.
I would presume that these families, of course, they're heavily involved in other areas such as the oil companies. I mean, they have cross-cutting allegiances in oil, in the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
What is their interest in waging the wars in the Middle East, for instance? Is it in their interest to have military campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Absolutely. War is part and parcel with economic crisis. You look at history and the history of capitalism and the history specifically of the 20th century, and anytime there's an economic crisis, a major economic crisis, it's also marked by a period of international war and international instability, increased violence. And, you know, this is because crisis, whether economic, military, you know, strategic, these types of things, political or economic, these are major reorganizing tools of society. George Orwell had a quote where he said in 1984, war is not meant to be won, it's meant to be continuous. It's because war is not meant to be waged against a foreign nation, but against the class of society, against the own domestic population, because war keeps the people impoverished, and it keeps class structure in tight control, and it intelligent. It doesn't allow them to progress too far in society. It doesn't allow them to become intelligent, to become thinking, and to rise up in society. It keeps the class structure. It keeps the social conditions in control. It's the total organizing principle of society. And, you know, in the 20th century, it was World War that created the League of Nations. And then it was the Great Depression, which collapsed the world order. And then that led to World War II, which was, ironically enough, the solution to the Great Depression and what brought the world out of the Great Depression. And now that we're on the verge of a new Great Depression, or as, you know, possibly the greatest depression, we're also looking at the prospects of another world war. And, you know, these sorts of things will result in basically a collapse of international society. But these people function through the concept of order out of chaos, using destruction as a form of creation. If you want to remold the entire world, you have to tear down the existing order first. It's too hard to just build on top of it. Sometimes you just need to clear the board and start anew. And that's ultimately what they're doing. And also, war will act as a means to play off powers against each other. And, you know, like throughout history, these interests have financed every side of every major war since the Napoleonic era. So war is always in their interest, because no matter who wins, they win.
We are talking to our guest, Andrew Marshall, who is independent writer and analyst of the New World Order. He's based in Vancouver. He's speaking to us from Montreal. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Stay with us.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, the final segment. Our guest, Andrew Marshall. This is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization, Global Research, based in Montreal. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Andrew, I presume that these families also control the media.
Absolutely. There's really very few areas that their reach does not extend into. The media is itself just a conglomeration of corporations. And these mega corporations are highly influenced and controlled by banking interests. I mean, just look at News Corporation. Go to the board of directors of News Corporation online. This is Murdoch's company. And you will see an executive from J.P. Morgan Chase. You will see an executive from Rothschild & Sons. Like, these interests are very much, and even, you know, look at PBS. You have a Rockefeller on the board of PBS. You know, so these, they tend to exert their influence over every sphere possible. And they've done this through generations of, I guess, what Antonio Gramsci would call a war of movement, where slowly, incrementally infiltrating every sector of society to essentially create a slow-moving revolution that works in their interest. Because, you know, bankers can't undertake a quick revolution over society and totally change it, because a banker leads no army. They command no army, lead no nation, inspire no people. They're there for themselves. So they have to incrementally, slowly, control, influence, infiltrate, manipulate. And that's how they exert their influence. And they create a system in which most of the players don't understand the system. They just know their part within it. You know, so these top people in media may not understand what system they're part of. but they understand their role within the system. They understand what constitutes news and what doesn't, what gets covered, what doesn't. You know, they know how to play the game. They know how to, you know, get ahead because they got ahead somehow. And you get ahead if you play the game.
Andrew, we just have less than, I think, about a minute more on the program. I think the crucial question is, how do we reverse the tide, and what can be done individually and collectively to establish a more democratic world order?
First, I think we need a revolution in thinking. I think people, sort of a new renaissance, a new enlightenment, before great action is undertaken, I think there's a need for reflection and thought. But it has to be quick because, you know, we're in the process of everything being undertaken. And I don't think that drastic action should be taken because usually it backfires. And I think that there needs to be a general awakening. And that from there we can find solutions. And I think, you know, personally, I'd like the idea of localized governance, localized economies, these types of things, because then it gives the people more say and more influence over their own lives, over their own system of economics, of governance. It puts it in their hands. And just to quote Antonio Gramsci, he has the saying, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. And I think that's just an excellent quote, and it kind of sums up my position.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Those are very incisive viewpoints. We are at the end of our program. This is the Global Research News Hour. Our guest, Andrew Marshall. Stephen Lenman will be back tomorrow at 10 Central Time, 11 Eastern Time. This is Michel Chassadovsky from Montreal.